Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this ordinary general meeting. As you've noticed already, we're doing it in a more informal fashion than our normal meetings, and that's deliberate because we want to have a free-flowing, open discussion. Before we do get on to the discussion, first of all, the minutes of the last general meeting were posted on the notice board. Can I have your approval to those minutes, please? Thank you. I'd like to extend a welcome to any guests here tonight and invite them to join in our discussion. Feel free to do so. Before we start the discussion, it's my very great pleasure, on behalf of the Institute of Actuaries, to present a Finlayson Medal to Professor Howard Waters from Heriot Watt University. The bare bones of Howard's career are brief. After a first degree and PhD in mathematics in Oxford and a short period as a trainee actuary at a consultancy, he joined Heriot Watt University in 1975, qualified as a Fellow of the Institute in 1976, and was later elected as a Fellow of the Faculty in 1998. However, those bare bones belie a very full and distinguished actuarial and academic career. Professor Howard Waters is a leading academic actuary working in the UK today. His body of work is outstanding, both in its breadth and depth. In a climate of increasing specialisation, few academics can claim significant contributions in more than one area. Professor Waters has published important, profound work in risk theory, life insurance solvency, and in multiple state modelling for long-term sickness benefits, and more recently for critical illness insurance. His work encompasses rigorous mathematical analysis, complex numerical algorithms, and practical applications. In the UK, Professor Waters' main impact has been in the area of modelling for the pricing and reserving of long-term sickness benefits. In his Journal of the Institute of Actuaries paper in 1984, he demonstrated the advantages of a multiple state approach to valuing PHI benefits. Subsequently, he co-authored the seminal paper in CMIB report number 12, which revolutionised the actuarial valuation of sickness benefits. In this work, Professor Waters became deeply involved both in the analytics of semi-Markov models as well as in the complex numerical methods required to calculate actuarial values for pricing and reserving factors. The impact of this work was very substantial, as the modelling of sickness benefits was finally placed on a sound theoretical foundation after decades of ad hoc methodology and outdated tables. Further, this methodology is now firmly entrenched in the actuarial curriculum. More recently, Professor Waters, together with colleagues Professor MacDonald and Dr. Wekweti, has developed more complex multiple state models for critical illness insurance, offering a theoretical grounding for an emerging product. This latter work also extends to the modelling of genetic factors in insurance. Internationally, Professor Waters is probably best known for his work in risk theory, where together with Professor David Dixon of the University of Melbourne, he's published a series of papers providing analytical and numerical solutions to complex problems in ruin theory, such as calculating the distributions of the time to ruin, the severity of ruin, and the surplus before ruin. He has also applied risk theory to the analysis of optimal reinsurance. This work has been recognised by the award of prizes by the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and by our own institute. He's also served the UK actuarial community in numerous ways. 8 years on the research committee, 12 years on the board of examiners, including serving as a chief examiner, member of the university liaison committee, and of the social policy board, where he's currently chairman of the actuaries panel on medical advances. He is a frequent author of sessional meeting papers and publications in international journals. Lastly, but by no means least, he has been an inspirational teacher to generations of actuarial students at Heriot Watt. Howard, we are deeply grateful for all you've done for the actuarial profession in the UK, and this award is richly deserved. I'd like to invite you now to come forward and receive it. Howard has said he'd like to say a few words, not more than 25 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President, thank you for your very kind words. I must say I'm very pleased, if a little surprised, to be honoured by the award of this medal. 30 years ago, in 1976, I travelled down to Staple Inn from Scotland, as I have today, to receive my fellowship certificate from the then President, Mr. O'Brien. Looking back over those 30 years, two features stand out for me. The first is that, well, it's just been a lot of fun, really. Hasn't all been fun. I mean, occasionally it's been frustrating. It's always been challenging. There have been downs as well as ups. But basically, I've been having fun for over 30 years, and I plan to have fun for a few more years to come. One reason why it's been fun is that my job as an academic allows me considerable freedom to do whatever interests me. Being an examiner for the profession, being a member of CMI committees, teaching courses overseas, working on research projects with collaborators in the UK and overseas. I've enjoyed all of these activities. I've also enjoyed the other part of my job, which is lecturing to classes of undergraduates and master's students, supervising the research projects of master's and doctoral students. Young people don't always get a good press these days, but those I come across in my job are, on the whole, interesting. Well, they come from all parts of the world. They are respectful, they are motivated, they're enthusiastic and very able. Of course, they're not all like that. There is a non-zero standard deviation around the mean. But the standard deviation is pretty small and the mean is very high. I find it stimulating to work with these people, and I'm pleased when they stay in touch after graduating, as many of them do. Although their achievements after graduating are their own, I do feel a vicarious pride in them. And incidentally, I'm pleased to note with a touch of pride that two of this evening's panel members, that we'll hear from later, James and Cliff, are both Heriot Watt graduates. The second major feature which stands out for me from the past 30 years is how fortunate I've been in the people with whom I've been able to work. Time is so short that I can mention only a few of those people who've had a significant influence on my career. In 1975, I joined my current employer, Heriot Watt University, as the youngest member of a group of mostly young people in the Department of Actuarial Mathematics and Statistics, working, well, I guess perhaps developing would be the better word, under the successive leadership of Professors Jimmy Gray and John McCutcheon. Now, those of you who know Jimmy Gray and John McCutcheon, and I know there are several here who do, will not be surprised to hear that there was much good practice to be learned from being in such a group. Today, well, most of my colleagues are younger than I am. It's funny how that creeps up on you without you really noticing it, but it does. Leadership has passed to others. But the principles of excellence, integrity, and teamwork developed under Jimmy Gray and John McCutcheon are being reinforced under the leadership of Professor Andrew Cairns as head of department and Professor Angus MacDonald as the first director of the Maxwell Institute for the Mathematical Sciences in Edinburgh. It is truly a privilege to work with these people. In 1981, I was invited by Professor Jan Huym to spend a year at the Laboratory of Actuarial Maths in Copenhagen. Professor Huym is an inspiring man, and I learned a great deal from him and his colleagues, despite spending such a short time with them. At that time, 1981, Professor Huym's research was focused on the development of multiple state models and their application to actuarial problems. Such models, as I think we now know, are extremely useful in actuarial work. I was fortunate to be in the right place at the right time to learn about them. As the President mentioned, a large part of my research over the last 15 years has been in collaboration with Professor David Dixon, who's been at the University of Melbourne since 1993. Dave and I have known each other for years. We first met in the 1970s when he was a fresh-faced young undergraduate, and I was, I would like to think, a fresh-faced young lecturer. Dave and I have worked on many projects and published many papers together. I have visited him many times in Melbourne, and it's always a pleasure to be there. We have a lot of fun in each other's company, but we also get some work done. For my part, I can say I'm very proud of what we've achieved together. It's a pity Dave cannot be here this evening to share this event with me. One person whom I'm extremely pleased to see here this evening is Professor Mary Hardy. Mary and I have known each other for many years, and over that time I've developed considerable respect for her. First of all, I respect her as a colleague, a former colleague, since it's now 10 years since she moved from Scotland to the University of Waterloo in Canada. Mary is a colleague who works hard and who works for the team first, for herself last. If you have Mary as a colleague, life is easier. Secondly, I respect the quality of the advice Mary has given me in the past. Mary has given me her advice freely and frequently over the years on any number of issues. Sometimes her advice has been what I wanted to hear, and sometimes it's not. Always it's been valuable, and I've been extremely grateful for it. Most of all, I value Mary as a very, very good friend. That Professor David Wilkie is a special person need hardly be said in this hall. He is truly a giant among the world's actuaries. But one of David's qualities, which may not be obvious to those of you who have not had the privilege of working closely with him, is just how good he is at working with young people. And I suppose that I would have qualified as a young person when we first started working together in the early 80s. He is never impatient, he is always encouraging, he is always prepared to listen and always willing to learn. Although, given that he appears to have an encyclopedic knowledge of, well, everything, it's always surprising to find out there is more he can learn. I've been fortunate that for the larger part of my career, David has been there to give me the benefit of his knowledge and advice and to encourage me into areas I might otherwise never have explored, to guide me and to be a role model. I'm very pleased that my wife Carol Ann is here this evening, her first ever visit to Staple Inn. We were married nearly 35 years ago this year, and we were married while I was still a postgraduate student before I had any idea of becoming an actuary. Since that time, there have been many occasions when important decisions had to be made concerning my career. On each occasion, she has given me her full support. Both she and I know just how much she's contributed to whatever achievements bear my name. Since that day in 1976, when I received my fellowship certificate in this building from Mr. O'Brien, I've been proud to be a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries, proud to be a member of my chosen profession. I interpret the award of this medal as indicating that my profession is proud to have me as a member. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, that means a very great deal to me. Thank you.
Congratulations, Howard. He's not escaping. He's just sitting at the back because he's got to slip out later. I'd now like to invite the Master of the Worshipful Company of Actuaries, Jeremy Goford, to step forward to present the Worshipful Company of Actuaries prizes to Paul Dobson and Lisa Wright for their performance in Subject 402 and Subject 404 examinations in September 2005. Jeremy.
Good evening. My name is Jeremy Goford. I'm Master of the Worshipful Company of Actuaries, and as your President says, I'm here to present a couple of prizes to demonstrate that here are another two people of whom the profession is very proud, and I'll introduce them to Howard so he can reduce still further the average age of the people who he's worked with. The Worshipful Company of Actuaries is one of 107 livery companies in the city. Livery companies that go back a long way, like the goldsmiths and the leather sellers and the hackney carriage drivers and so on. The company is one of 30 modern livery companies who are restricted to their own trade, so new livery companies can only be formed of their own trade, and so the Worshipful Company of Actuaries is all actuaries. The livery companies support the Lord Mayor and the City of London Corporation, and indeed the liverymen elect the sheriffs and the Lord Mayor at Common Hall. The livery companies also channel some £50 million a year from their investments and contributions into charitable causes. The Company of Actuaries also promotes the actuarial profession in the city, otherwise known as UK Financial Services. So here's the ad. If you're an actuary who wants to and can influence and needs contacts important to you in your career in the city, if you're keen to promote the profession in the city, you're prepared to divert some of your well-gotten gains into our charitable trust, and that's important, and you enjoy the fellowship of actuaries and their guests at dinners of the company, then come and see me afterwards. So to the awards. The company awards prizes for excellence in the specialist exams as recommended by the examiners. And I now have pleasure in making the presentation of those prizes. Firstly, to Lisa Wright of Watson Wyatt, Manchester, for excellence in the papers on pensions and other benefits. Lisa.
Right, we now move on to our discussion. You may have already spotted, the more observant ones amongst you, that we have some cameras in the hall tonight. I'd like to explain that this is because we're using tonight's meeting as a pilot for webcasting CPD events in advance of the implementation of our new CPD scheme in July. The webcast will be posted on the members-only section of the website on Friday, the end of this week, and details of how to view it will be sent out via an email. And I have been told by the representative of the organisation who are doing this trial for us that if we want something taken out, before Friday we can have it taken out. So, the really important part of this message is: don't be put off joining in the discussion by the cameras. I should also say, when we get to the discussion part, that this discussion will not be recorded verbatim in the British Actuarial Journal. So we will be encouraging people to get up and make impromptu remarks and not to be worried that they will be recorded forever for posterity. The subject of this evening's informal discussion is actuaries and risk management. Risk management is a field of growing importance in many walks of life, in business, in commerce, and in government. Multinational companies now commonly employ a chief risk officer in the highest echelons of management, supported by a growing team of risk managers. Most businesses try to eliminate risk, but actuaries have always worked in areas such as insurance and pensions, where risk is deliberately taken on and then managed, and hopefully managed successfully. Thus, actuaries have a natural affinity for this new discipline of risk management. And our international colleagues in North America and Australia see risk management as the future of our profession, as the longer-term demand for pure insurance or pensions actuaries potentially stagnates or even declines in the future. The two councils are considering the future of the Institute and faculty in the aftermath of the Morris Review. And these questions about the future working patterns of actuaries, particularly for the younger members of the profession, are fundamental to that review. Insurance actuaries have been propelled firmly into the risk management space by the FSA regulatory changes brought in at the end of 2004. Indeed, at the Life Convention at the end of 2004, John Tyner praised the response from the actuarial profession to these new requirements. And pensions actuaries have seen their world turned upside down by the advent of large deficits and the changes in the regulatory framework, which are again pushing them into becoming risk managers. So this discussion tonight is particularly timely, and I would like to thank and congratulate the Finance, Investment and Risk Management Board on their initiatives to date in this field, including this opportunity to debate the subject. And at that point, I would like to hand over to Colin Wilson from the Finance and Investment and Risk Management Board to introduce the discussion. Colin.
Thank you, Michael. I'd like to add my own welcome from the Finance, Investment and Risk Management Board. Many of you will know that this used to be the Finance and Investment Board only, that the name was changed as the board was set up really with the further objective of being the driving force for developing and supporting the work of actuaries in risk management. As Michael's already said, as part of that, we have been strengthening our links with the Society of Actuaries in the US and the Institute of Actuaries in Australia, where their initiatives in risk management are already fairly well established. But as one of the earlier parts of this initiative, we released a statement from the board, amongst which we suggested that we are all risk managers now, although recognising that risk management is far more than just risk measurement. Value, after all, is created by taking some risks and avoiding others. It's fair to say that statement, we are all risk managers now, created some mixed reactions from within the profession. Some people said, what do you mean now? Actuaries have always been risk managers. Others said, well, I don't consider myself a risk manager. So that's really where this evening came from. We thought it would be a good idea to get people from the different traditional areas of actuarial involvement to explain what risk management means to them, perhaps to carry out a poll of which fields we think risk management is more appropriate to, maybe is more developed. So we have practitioners from each of the areas of life insurance, general insurance and pensions to speak this evening. And some of the questions that we're hoping will be answered, both by them and by yourselves later, are those of which areas are the most advanced in risk management? Do actuaries need a change in mindset to help them make the most of the opportunities here? What part should be played by the education system in all this? And do actuaries need broader experience in order to make the most of those opportunities? Perhaps I could start just with a straw poll. If I give you one vote each for either life insurance, general insurance or pensions, it would be interesting to know, both now and at the end of the evening, which field those present think is the most advanced in the area of risk management. So could I ask for a show of hands for those who wish to vote for life insurance, please? That's quite a good response, thank you. General insurance? Yes, also fairly good, maybe not quite so many. Pensions? We'll see if our speakers this evening manage to change that view. Cliff, perhaps I could start with you in order to... I'll ask them to speak in the order, slightly different from the programme. Cliff Speed speaking on about pensions, Philip Long on life insurance, and James Orr on general insurance.
Thank you, Colin. I'll start by saying, despite the brand of the slides, these are my personal views, don't represent the company I work for. I also, to a certain degree, I'm not going to play the game. I'm not going to stand here and say, my risk management is bigger than better than your risk management, because I've had experience with dealing with actuaries before, and you're all fairly independently minded people. So you'll come to your own conclusions and won't listen to me. So let's start with saying, OK, what are the risks we face in pensions? It's exciting how slowly it changes, isn't it? God. Right, I have to get used to that. OK, so surely the main risk must be that pensions won't be paid. There's also a subsidiary risk that essentially the costs of those pensions spiral out of control and so pension schemes are stopped. Now, think how long pension schemes have been going, particularly corporate pension schemes, which companies, actuaries advise. And they've been going for a heck of a long time. So if we look back, we can say the 20th century was a resounding success. Millions of people receiving pensions and are enjoying a higher standard of living than they otherwise would have. And those pension schemes continued. So come the end of the millennium, what happened? There was a great big vote of thanks, wasn't there? Well, actually, no, there wasn't. Quite the reverse, you might say. Hey? There was a lot of criticism about actuaries, and there was quite a bombard of negative press. Eventually we get things going. Okay. So this surely raises a few questions. How was it the profession was so successful for so long in dealing with all these great risks? And what happened at the start of the 21st century? Was there some perfect storm which came along and disrupted pensions, something which is so beyond previous experience that actuaries and the people they dealt with just really couldn't deal with? I like to think of this, was it a case of the four horsemen of the pensions apocalypse came and destroyed out of the world? Well, maybe not. To understand what's happened in pensions and risk management, we need to look back. If I look back 10 years, I get back to the time when I first started working at an actuarial consultancy. In those days, most actuarial valuations were done on a traditional basis, 9-7-5. And maybe to some of the older pensions actuaries, there's a warm glow of familiarity. Oh, that's a long-lost friend. I remember that traditional basis. Okay? But what this did is it divorced the valuation of liabilities from capital markets. We also were in a situation where mortality was not the major issue it is today. In other words, we'd essentially fixed one side of the balance sheet. But that still left the assets. And their infuriating habit of fluctuating the economic conditions. Terrible. But don't worry, help was at hand with the actuarial value of assets. Hopefully, there are quite a few younger members in the audience who are saying, huh? What's that? Well, this is a graph I was shown shortly after I started work, and basically the wiggly line shows the market value of an actual asset portfolio, fairly typical asset allocation for a pension scheme at that time. And the nice smooth blue line showed the actuarial value. And this was shown to me with some pride. Look at that! Isn't that amazing? This nasty irrational market value keeps on mean reverting to the actuarial value. Isn't that splendid? A classic example of mixing up cause and effect. I'm glad to say that such things as actuarial value of assets have now been consigned to history and fallen into disrepute. So essentially, we were looking at a position where we had fixed both sides of the balance sheet. You might characterise this as the mushroom school of risk management. But even in the late 1990s, changes were occurring. Market-based valuations were beginning to gain a hold. And this led to the idea of asset liability studies, where we could start communicating risk. Also, in this fall, in 1997, we had the paper by Exley, Mater and Smith, The Theory of Defined Benefit Schemes, which in its time was hugely controversial. But now, a lot of those ideas are generally accepted and becoming to be implemented. We also had in that year what, in hindsight, was the ill-conceived and ill-fated minimum funding requirement, which may be described as the last hurrah of the old orthodoxy. Asset liability studies, probably something we're quite familiar with. What are they? You project forward what's going to happen to the assets and the liabilities. There's a clue in the name if you're paying attention. And you see what happens in multiple economic scenarios. Okay? But when you're doing thousands and thousands of scenarios and you're looking at all different measures, presentation is an issue. But one of the most common ways of presenting it is looking at percentiles. You start from a known position, and as you go further forward, you get this expanding funnel of doubt, like shown on the graph behind. Now, this, of course, led to some difficulties in communication, But it's a clear example of actuaries showing uncertainty in their work. Despite what Derek Morris may have accused us of, this is a classic counterexample of us not claiming too much certainty as we look forward. Actuaries and investment consultants were truly communicating the risk and the uncertainty in future positions. Of course, there are many problems with asset liability studies. Okay? Some of the greatest risk scenarios are left out. You see, the bottom line only represents the 95th percentile, which was typical in pensions asset liability studies. Okay? And if I maybe did an asset liability study in 2000 and then saw what actually happened, I'd probably find something like this. The funding level isn't as good as I was projecting. Of course, I could expand my number, my percentiles, and show even more. But what are extreme values? What should be cut out? There are also issues with the time horizons and the assumptions shown. But for all of that, it was an approach which moved risk management forward. Now, asset liability studies are being replaced by a different approach to risk management. Essentially, instead of looking forward some arbitrary horizon and choosing certain measures, we look at current obligations and we project forward the obligations, the benefits which must be paid out to members, and find out what cash flows arise. And commonly give rise to some sort of profile like this. We can then consider different inflation scenarios and different demographic assumptions to see how these obligations change. Once we have that, we can then look at constructing a low-risk portfolio which delivers these sort of cash flows, and not only delivers those cash flows, but behaves in the same sort of way as these liabilities as economic conditions change. Essentially, we're looking at what is called delta hedging, something which is very common to any option trading desk in the city. This LDI approach has seen great growth. There may be around about 50 billion of pension assets currently with LDI mandates and growing. And it's partly due to LDI that there is now a common acceptance that pension liabilities are essentially bond-like. In fact, just about every major institution involved in pensions has made some sort of statement about the bond-like nature of pension liabilities. So I would say there's been great strides made on the investment side for pensions risk management. But now let me turn to another area of equal importance, funding. This is an area which is still quite contentious, but there seems to be a growing acceptance that when we talk about pension liabilities, what we really mean is the cost of buying out those liabilities. How much does it cost to pass that obligation to someone else? And pensions actuaries are becoming to accept this. Personally, I think they're wrong. They need to allow for a further addition of reserves, because if you're not buying out today, those rates may move against you. But roundabout out buyout is where we are. Or going to it. Of course, there are many other measures of pension liabilities. We have accounting measures, which use typically AA bond discount rates. And then, of course, we have what actuaries commonly use in funding, which use the expected return. In other words, capitalise excess returns for risky assets which may or may not be received in the future. And now we begin to see the magically shrinking liabilities as you continue to increase the discount rate. Of course, if I've got assets which are around about this level, I might get to the bizarre situation where I say on a funding valuation, you're fully funded, but you have insufficient assets to meet your liabilities. So we have a fully funded scheme which is in deficit. Am I being harsh? Well, what does the pensions regulator say about a deficit? He says, deficit means buyout. Goes on to say that a framework around FRI 17 can only be used where there is no doubt the employer will continue as a going concern. That's a pretty harsh test. The regulator also says that a pension scheme in deficit should be treated the same as any other material unsecured creditor. That is a massive statement. In fact, it's not a statement, it's a guiding principle from the regulator. And what that tells us is suddenly the employer's covenant, that credit risk exposure you have to the sponsor, is suddenly on our radar screen. To me, that's a huge relief, It's almost as if there's been an elephant in the corner which no one has dared mention, and yet now we can look at it and consider it properly. Pensions actuaries are dealing with this now. It's not easy, but it's at least out there and we can start dealing with it. But let me return to the funding issue because it's so important. Here are the assets we have. And this value of the liabilities may be justified because of a high exposure to risky assets, say equities. Now, this creates great problems in risk management. Imagine you're a trustee and you're sitting there and you're told, well, your assets and liabilities are just about in balance. And as a prudent trustee, you think, well, okay, I will take some risk off the table. I know my liabilities are bond-like. I will shift into bonds. The response could be, ah, well, if you're going to do that, I'm going to reduce your discount rate, and suddenly you'll have a deficit. Now, that could cause huge problems for the trustees. They may have to go back to the sponsor and negotiate over deficit contributions, okay? A recovery plan, which they'd previously been told they didn't need. They might have to go and communicate to members that suddenly there's a hole in the pension scheme when they'd recently told them it was all okay. These are disincentives to risk management. In every, and of course, having mismatched assets, they could go down and increase that deficit. In just about every other area of financial management, if the collateral, in other words, the pension assets you post, is inappropriate or does not match the obligations, you need more of it, not less. This is an important area which I think further progress could be made. But let's return to the employer covenant, because this is a key issue where actuaries have been grappling and been doing very well, I think. The change in the recognition of that credit risk has put pensions clearly in the space of capital management. Okay? It is now quite clear that pension liabilities are, for all intents and purposes, corporate liabilities, and the pension assets are collateral to offset those liabilities. So it's, in that context, it's less surprising that we're seeing more and more corporates raising finance or using cash on the balance sheets to plug pension scheme deficits. And that is surely one of the best routes of risk management, making sure the collateral is there to meet the obligations. It's also important to realise the change in the nature of the pension liabilities we've seen in recent years. I won't bore you with all the details of the legislative changes. Instead, we can look at it in a heuristic graphical form. What I'm showing is, over time, how essentially the pension liability has gone from being unguaranteed, corporate guarantee, to almost being fully guaranteed. We've seen a transition from a with-profits policy with very low level of guarantees to essentially a fully non-profit policy. Okay? And that has gone even further with the recent introduction of the PPF, which provides a second layer of protection behind that. The environment which we're operating in has changed quite radically. So, in summary, mark-to-market is essentially established for assets and has been for a while. There is still some growing pain, shall we say, on the liability side. The nature of the liabilities has been clarified as being bond-like, and we're seeing some quite sophisticated hedging strategies being put in place. Okay. The employer covenant, the credit risk, is now recognised. Now, actuaries may not be qualified from their education and experience to date to put in place the solutions, but the first rule of risk management is to recognise the risks, and that has been done. Mortality is receiving far greater attention than it's ever done before, and rightly so. And we're seeing better disclosure, not only from accounts, but in actuarial valuations. I could also mention taxation. So what would be my end-of-term report? Well, I'd probably say 7 out of 10. Damn good progress, particularly when you consider where we started from. But given the potential within the profession, it's capable of more. And of course, you say, well, what more? Is there a final solution? Shouldn't use those terms. It's got bad connotations, hasn't it? Well, there are probably two ways you could have a complete solution so trustees and corporate discharge their obligations. One, get yourself a Crown guarantee. Hard, but some people are trying. Secondly, you could actually achieve your aim by buying out your liabilities with an insurance company. You've met your liabilities, you've passed them across, you have done your job, tick in box. Maybe now I ought to hand over to my insurance colleague to tell us about risk management and insurance.
Good evening. Like my esteemed pensions and GI colleagues here, I've been asked to spend 10 minutes, actually 12, Colin, in my case, on the life insurance perspective on which actuaries make the best risk managers, covering four subtopics, which fields are most advanced, is the change of mindset required, the part played by the education system, and should actuaries broaden their experience earlier on in their career. First, a few remarks on the last two subtopics. On actuarial education, I'm confident that the education system will continue to evolve to help actuaries grasp new opportunities. I note that the US Society of Actuaries, which has its own risk management section, has a mission statement which says, I quote, to further the education and research in the areas of risk management and establish leading risk management techniques. Tonight's meeting is an example of the similar direction the faculty and institute are taking and heading, and actuarial education will no doubt follow in close support. On the issue of whether actuaries should seek to broaden their experience earlier on, I would say most certainly yes. Risk management is about managing each component of risk and disseminating best practice in order to protect policyholders and create value for shareholders. Now, when I joined the profession many moons ago, that was what I believed the actuarial function was all about. However, I think that somehow we actuaries got lost along the way. Hence, the gap has been filled by the rapid growth of risk management to meet this challenge. Now, as while we pensions, GI, and life actuaries can spend time musing this evening over which of our fields are most advanced, I think there is little doubt in my mind that it is the area of banking that has led the way. Unfortunately, one wonders whether this is at all linked to the fact that banking has never really been considered as a traditional actuarial area. If you think, for example, about the illiquid middle market lending portfolio and thus has parallels with these illiquid insurance liabilities that we hold, banks have long realized the superiority of active risk management over originate and hold strategies. The key to all of this, actually, is the creation of a secondary market. Rather than warehouse the risk and have to hold capital to back them, securitizations, for example, have let banks pass on the risk to the capital markets and thus increase their returns on capital. Virtuous cycle. Active risk management means you can originate profitably depending on your distribution footprint and then manage concentrations to diversify the risk away. There is also additional rigor around transaction level pricing with use of statistical models for PDFs and historical parameterizations for LGDs and EADs. All this activity leads to convergence in market standards that are both consistent and transparent, and encouragement from regulators keen to see improved risk management. The fact that a secondary market exists then naturally leads to people using this as a rational basis for primary market pricing, another virtuous circle. Now, the driver for risk management now in insurance is the realization that insurance risks really aren't that different from banking risks. They aren't that much more complicated. Now, we don't really need to rely on traditional actuarial smoke and mirrors, really. Now, you hear these actuarial objections all the time, and I name three here. We cannot work out in a transparent and objective manner the cost of managing the risk of our long-tail business. Now, how interesting is this? If you can't quantify the risk, why are you writing it? And how do banks actually find solutions to long-tail credit behavior? what is a 1 in 1,000 credit event? We don't understand how policyholders will behave. Well, how do banking models deal with complex prepayment behavior on the mortgage-backed security market? Or we're only in the fifth year of our 10-year program of model development. How do banks then generate daily reports of their complex trading activities? Now, if you set out to get the right answer from the business perspective, surely the technology must follow. Now, I'm not saying for one moment that banks' tranching is spot on, or their characterization of retail prepayment behavior is 100% accurate. But the key thing is that in the process of establishing the cost of managing this risk, you make it transparent and well understood. The market then takes this line in the sand and makes its mind up by putting a price on it. Now, some major life insurers have realized that there is massive potential gains from active risk management. Of course, this has been helped along by pressures from our regulators, our rating agencies, and accountants as well, and also help from reinsurers and our bankers. Additionally, we can be grateful for actuaries from the Exley Mather Smith contingent and others for giving our profession a kick up the backside. Sorry for the rather busy slide, but I think I found this schematic originally introduced in 2001 by some very clever Swiss Re people immensely helpful. Advanced life insurance risk managers are using this sort of framework for managing the risk throughout their business. Basically, what you can do is to decompose the economic balance sheet based on the market value of assets and liabilities into its component profit centers. This lends itself to a transparency of where the risk is and where value is coming from. When performed on a consistent basis across business units, this then allows a proper apples-to-apples comparison that facilitates capital allocation decisions. No smoke and mirrors here. On the left of the chart here, you see the manufacturing function who holds assets equal to the replicating portfolio. This function is fully accountable for product design and market-consistent pricing. The key here is to ensure that on liability origination, premiums exceed the market-consistent liability. No fiddling about with making an underwriting loss with the expectation or hope of making profits from asset risk premia. Bundling it together, perhaps, in a non-transparent and potentially misleading manner. Now, any profits from investments belongs to the people on the right-hand side, the investment functions whose liabilities are the SAA portfolio. To the extent that insurers choose to focus on both liability origination and investment management, the investment role here is to outperform on the asset management side. And in the center, you have the risk and capital management piece, who set the risk appetite, manage risk and capital, allocate returns and capital costs between the different functions, and also actively hedge and take into account risk mitigation and diversification. The position is communicated then unambiguously to management, and best practice is disseminated. Now, a key objective of this sort of framework is, like in the banking example, the development of a functioning secondary market. This then allows insurers to become more capital efficient, increase their ROCs, and allows more rational pricing in the primary market through the discipline of the secondary market. Now, is the change of mindset required to make the most of opportunities? Yes, I think. And I outline three principles here. The first thing is that the old mindset thinks that actuaries are God. The new mindset we need to understand is actuaries are human. The principle is we are not God. And the reality check here is really the key solution to all our problems, I think. The old mindset is thinking that we actuaries own the truth. And here is the guy from The Matrix, the evil guy. And of course, the good guy is... The new mindset is that the truth is actually out there. The principle here is that humility. We need to be humble and less insular. We can and must learn from other disciplines and industries, and we need to also learn and work with others within our own industries. Like the other pictures here, I've pulled them off the internet. So, the old mindset is the old statement, just trust me, I'm an actuary. And I hope what follows is not too risque, but given that we've had a naked man already and Keanu Reeves, I'm sure in the interest of balance, we can have, I think it's Claudia Schiffer, but I'm not sure, my secretary. And the principle here is transparency. We need to justify and communicate our thought processes better. This transparent analysis is always helped by sensible modeling, and our actuarial judgment will always be the better for it. And we can build supermodels with super brains, or perhaps better to hide this super brains behind a sleek exterior. Now, the alternative to all this is to find out that, which I think the actual profession has found out in the past, that the emperor has had no clothes, really. So, is a change of mindset required to make the most of opportunities? Yes. There is huge potential for value creation. Hence, risk management is a growth industry now. Many opportunities and challenges are common to three fields. For example, GI and life together can use the and should use the risk management framework that I outlined earlier to decompose value creation and risk management between liability origination, investment management, and also risk and capital management. And another example is the growth in the bulk purchase annuity market, alongside regulatory-led market-consistent valuations in for life, and also the accounting-led financial reporting approaches like FRS 17 and IS 19 for pensions. This has led to a convergence of technology for both pensions and life insurance. Some opportunities and challenges are, of course, more unique. For example, while some GI risks have lent itself easy to rigorous statistical analysis, some others still may be very subjectively treated. But going back to our banking example, are things really too complicated for clever minds here to deal with? Can we not actually, as a profession, help facilitate transparent convergence of market practice? If we don't do this, someone else will do it for us, and our profession will be the poorer for it. And if it really is too complicated to do, then we should step back and ask ourselves again, why are we writing risk on the basis of crystal ball gazing? We need to put on a mindset of reality, humility, and transparency. And it is possible to do that. Thank you.
Good stuff. Yeah, another consultant.
Good afternoon, or good evening, I should say. Very pleased to be speaking to you this afternoon. I was a little bit taken aback by, I think you were right in reporting that the GI area actually did quite well in that vote. Did we? Yeah. So I'm about to destroy our lead. Okay. GI actuaries, as you may know, have been very busy of late. We came in for a bit of criticism from the rating agency Standard & Poor's AM Best for the work we, and I include the kind of US colleagues in this, had done in regard to asbestos risks. And the whole idea that actuaries were saying they could predict the future and say what reserves need to be held in respect of these long-tail liabilities. And when you look at the thing as a whole, it has not gone very well, and there was a whole question about the actuarial credibility. And in fact, that was a title that the American actuaries chose to use for their response to those criticisms. And one of the first challenges I had was, of course, my working title for this evening. And you may be aware that we've had the GRIT working party, which is a general insurance Reserving Issues Task Force. We've also managed to twist the thinking on pricing into GRIP Working Party. For this evening, I'm going to be doing GRIM, which is the General Insurance, Are We Really Risk Managers? And hopefully I can give you some examples as to why we're risk managers and also perhaps talk about why we're not risk managers. Okay, this is an outline of what I'm going to discuss this afternoon, or this evening. I'm going to start by defining and characterising risk management. I feel it is worth talking about that and getting clear on that. Describing much more briefly what GI actuaries get up to, I assume most of you are pretty clued up on that. And then a bit of special pleading. I think Phil and Cliff have set up the argument quite neatly as to what role insurance plays in all this, and I'll be explaining why we are so special. And then, just to finish off and remind you of what the questions are, I'll go through the actual questions for this evening. Okay, so what is risk management? Well, I feel that risk management is not like other things. It's not like you know it when you see it. I think risk management actually is a lot of different things to different people. And I'd like to go later on through different examples or mindsets that could actually be called risk management. They are very different from each other. And what I'm thinking about here is about looking at what's going on, learning and acting on the basis of risk, and actually using that to assess risks, monitor them, and ultimately make a decision about how you treat risks, whether you retain them, you transfer them, you mitigate them, or you avoid them altogether. And of course, the objective, which you have to be clear about, is that we want to improve the risk situation, but get that balance right. So that's about improving the security of an operation, but also ultimately its performance. And this is a little picture I like to use. I mean, I thought I'd try and get control cycle in an actuarial talk. It seems to be standard kind of brief. What I've said here is that, you know, we do this instinctively. You know, we've got this built into us. Instinctively, we do this all the time. We learn all the time. We look at the world around us. We form a mental model based on what we've seen. That then defines our hypotheses or even our prejudices. Then we look at the world as it unfolds again through the eyes of that new mental model, all the time updating. And the scientific method is based on this. Risk management is based on this. We look at complex systems. We try and understand how they work. We make predictions how they're going to work in the future. This is our kind of control experimental cycle. And generally, I believe, because I think it is actually built into us, it's not something we have to learn, we make it explicit, that is underlying a lot of risk management. I want to recommend a little bit of a kind of reading to you. You may remember, or some of you may have seen about a month ago or so, there started a piece in the Financial Times, which was on Mastering Uncertainty, which was a series of kind of four Friday specials, which had a lot of talks or specially commissioned pieces in it about mastering uncertainty. And the particular one I wanted to pick on was by Donald Sull. And what Donald Sull from London Business School does is he starts talking, basically opening this whole piece, and he talks about uncertainty and risk, and he talks about Frank Knight's who's an economist, wrote in 1921 a seminal paper on risk, uncertainty, and profit. Now, you'll notice here he was distinguishing between two things. He was distinguishing between risk and uncertainty. I have to confess that before I got involved in this field, I just used those two interchangeably. I tend to use risk more often. It's a shorter word, easier to spell. And the point he was making was that we could distinguish risk from uncertainty in the sense that risk was something where the kind of actions that we might take, the position we might take, were very simple. You might say a gambler takes a risk, but perhaps a tightroper deals with uncertainty. The example he used in particular was about investment. I think investment's very straightforward. You either lose your money, you don't. whereas in insurance, you either lose your money, you lose lots of money. And in complexity terms, what he was saying was when you get beyond a certain level of complexity, you move out of a world where you can slice and kind of deconstruct the risks or the uncertainty you face into elements of risk. And you have to deal with the complexity. And I want to argue that insurance, general insurance, deals with that complexity. It deals with the mess. It interfaces with the real world. We've got very neat and well-designed and developed structures in terms of debt, which is basically a lump of money that, if things go well, you get interest in the money back. And we've got equity, where you give money to a company operation, and they'll give you a share in profits for the future, and you've got a secondary a market in which you can then trade that equity in the future. Those are two good solutions. And in the middle, all the messy stuff, that's where insurance comes in. I also thought this talk might be of interest to Vice President Dick Cheney as well, when I actually saw mastering and gun certainty would be useful for him. Okay, so Here's, I wasn't actually briefed to put in lame jokes, but they just come naturally. Okay, what I want to talk about here is this argument about, you know, where does insurance actually sit? And if we think about the financial services sector as a whole, what it's doing is it deals with the world of risk. We've got to take risk. No risk, no gain. It's pretty straightforward. Everybody accepts that. And what I've tried to do here is in my kind of distiller, I've got my risks going in at the top there. I've got Microsoft and, you know, other nasty things. And I've got the idea that there's financeable risks, risks that you can actually, you know, kind of borrow against, and that people say, yeah, I'll lend you money to buy a car and you can drive it on the road or whatever. But you've got to buy insurance, kind of thing. Then you've got insurable risks, and then uninsurable and other risks. And what I'm arguing is that the debt kind of aspect of the thing deals with banks, and the equity side of things and other more kind of complex risks that are insurable are dealt with by companies, individuals, and society. Now, say somebody is setting up an airline, a low-cost airline, and they go to kind of borrow some money to buy a plane. Usually the first thing the bank will say to them is, have you got insurance? Have you got insurance to protect this asset? Have you got insurance against the kind of trade-in value of that plane 6 years down the line after you've put a few million miles on the clock? So insurance is dealing all the time with these risks that banks say, oh, we don't want to deal with that, too risky. And what I would also say is that in terms of the kind of insurance market, those delineations, those partings between the kind of fundable, financeable risk and insurance, and between insurance and the kind of, shall we say, the uninsurable risks, all the time, because we work in a kind of free market, all the time those boundaries are being pushed and moving back and forward, and underwriters are being tempted to write stuff that's really financial guarantees, really, and risks that they really shouldn't cover. I mean, the point was made, why do we actually cover risks that we can't price? Well, because somebody offers us money to take them on. That's why it is. And society needs cover for those long-tail liabilities. We're asked to cover them. There's a need there. So we do cover risks that really should just stay in that dangerous pot in the bottom. Okay, I'll speed up now. I've just got a few kind of characterizations. I was saying before about risk management and different styles. One of those basic styles, which I think is, shall we say, the traditional view, is health and safety, doing it by the book. You've got the proper protocols that you have to follow in the workplace, say, about the way you lift heavy objects, all this kind of thing. That's very much about regulation, training, good practice. There's a bureaucracy around that. It's all about protecting people. There's a huge kind of health and safety kind of industry there, which is being more heightened now by kind of corporate kind of manslaughter or corporate responsibility arguments. People have got to think much more carefully about the risks that their business creates for the people who work for them and who are affected by their businesses. Then the next one is the instinctive one. And I've got to be honest here. I actually think that a lot of actuaries, possibly myself included, we sit in this kind of instinctive, on-the-run kind of view that we live by the principles of risk management. We don't make it explicit. We don't say, well, stop the process. Let's cut it up into pieces. Let's see if we can turn this uncertainty into risk. Let's see if we can hedge all this stuff off. Because I work in insurance. I work with very messy, complex risks. It's too difficult. And of course, there's the what I like to call the Masters of the Universe model of quantitative analysis. You know the Tom Wolfe novel, Bonfire of the Vanities, with Sherman McCoy. Well, I think that's Sherman McCoy there with his beautiful jawline. And what they do there is they take risk. They understand it. They can slice it. They've got the secondary market behind them. They actually deal with risk. And they get really annoyed by the idiots who can't deal with insurance. Well, that's how it feels anyway. Maybe just a bit defensive. But, you know, there's a definite model there in terms of what can be achieved. Because I would like to argue that these people are dealing with risk, because they have managed to partition and simplify the issues they're dealing with. And in thinking about motivation, I'm going to argue that's a police car rather than a taxi at the top there. There's definite kind of different motivations for risk management. I do speak to people from the banking world who say it's money well spent on risk management because it gets the regulator off our backs. And now, it might be that for certain members of banking management that is a good enough argument and that's done. But, you know, we do have to be clear that a lot of what has happened has been driven. I think you were saying about the helpful regulators, supportive regulators, have been driven by people saying, look, you've got to get a handle on this. You've got to be clear on what your kind of VAR position is. So there's a lot of force comes from the regulator. there's a lot of force comes from, well, we want to stay in the game. We don't want to just blow the, you know, lose the farm in terms of the activity to go on. And ultimately, I think there is the argument of beating the competition. Can we actually manage risk so well that we get an economic advantage from it? And I think there are some successful businesses that illustrate that approach. I have one slide on what GI actuaries do, in case you don't know what it is. There's three main areas: reserving, capital assessment, and pricing that we get involved in. On the reserving side, I think there was in the presentation on Howard's kind of contribution to the actuarial profession, there was talk about ad hoc models and how his critical illness work. Well, we're waiting for Howard on the reserving side, because at the moment we're still using ad hoc models. We're still shape-fitting to claims development. There is a lot of work being done now on stochastic models, excellent stuff by Richard Verrill and Peter England, but to some extent it's still retrofitting on an old shape-fitting kind of methodology. And we do need to have that kind of breakthrough and say, yeah, guys, we can understand the underlying process behind reserving, and we can have a better picture of that. Capital assessment, the FSA has a very difficult question to answer, and a lot of work has been done in the last 2 or 3 years in the general insurance area that really has pushed us forward. I think in terms of how technically advanced GI actuaries are, it's changed radically in the last 5 years. The kind of entry level in terms of kind of technical proficiency required of GI actuaries has jumped by virtue of this type of work. Got a strong drive from the regulators, as we were saying before, and we've seen very sophisticated models come out. But one of the problems is that if you look at this kind of loss profile I've got here in the bottom, this is trying to characterise risk or uncertainty, is that we're being asked to look at problems where that lovely little model, our control cycle, where we looked at the world, we made judgments about it, we had our mental model, we updated, we looked at the world, etc. Well, they keep asking us questions about things we've never seen. We've never seen these 1 in 200-year events. We've never seen, well, until the start of the century, we've never seen, you know, huge hurricanes. We've never seen massive accumulations from terrorist attacks. And those are very difficult questions to answer because we didn't have the data, and we tend not to have the kind of underlying exposure information from which to build up a proper view of risk. And in pricing, we're seeing growing influence, but I make the point we're seeing that particularly in structured lines, where there's almost a simple nature to the contracts, like catastrophe bonds, where you've got a very clear objective measure, an underlying stock, shall we say, a clear objective measure of what's going to trigger a loss to a particular contract. Okay, here's my slide on why GI actuaries are special. And this is it. But what I'm going to argue is that the insurance, our role in dealing with the kind of waste, shall we say, the middle ground, the no man's land between what debt can cope with, what equity can cope with, there's issues there of information asymmetry. A lot of insurance contracts are on an indemnity basis. We will pay out for the loss you experience, not for the amount of money we said we'd pay you in the first place. So it's not that there's a defined capital value on a loan which you just default out. It is the fact they look at how much it's going to cost to fix your house. They look at how much it's going to cost to compensate someone for, you know, asbestosis or you know, some kind of serious condition. And those are very kind of unknown issues in terms of what those indemnity losses could be. As I said before, we cover the stuff that everybody else says, no, we don't want it. So that's a problem. There's no underlying stock that we can look at. There's no secondary market. I mean, there are attempts coming through to create those secondary markets in terms of what's called industry loss warranties. And those contracts are starting to define something which is quite a neat interface between capital markets and insurance. And that's coming along very nicely. Underwriters keep putting in clauses, you know, saying we'll cover all your suppliers, unnamed or otherwise, and if one of your suppliers gets impacted by an event and your business suffers as a result, we'll pay out on that. So that's what's called contingent liability insurance or contingent business interruption insurance, and that was often just thrown in for free. So you've got underwriters from the market being told to put in stuff that can't be priced. Again, you know, it's in there, can't be priced, but the market says it should be in there. There are unusual assets that we cover. The terms that we have on contracts are infinitely variable. You know, we can retain more of the risk, or we can cover more of the risk. And then finally, the actual type of events that we cover, well, people want protection against the unknown, the uncertain. So those events, by their very nature, we can't see in advance what they're going to be. So that's why GI actuaries are special. Okay, so I'll try not to whine on for too much longer. I did feel as if I was representing the whingers when I saw Phil's slides earlier. Which actuarial fields are most advanced in areas of risk management? I think GI actuaries don't do a bad job because they do interface with this mess of reality. We haven't got this kind of neat risk world that we can manipulate. But I do think that we could do a lot better job if we did go back to first principles and look at risk management and say, okay, how do we cut this up? Maybe we should be turning around and saying, look, you shouldn't really be covering those risks. That's, you know, if you can't price them, you shouldn't be covering them. And we have got skills honed on difficult, unique problems. GI actuaries tend to be creating models quite a lot, and they're always dealing with inadequate data. There's nothing new there, I suppose. Is a change of mindset required? I think there is. I think we need to perhaps engage more and say to the businesses that we advise, we can help you manage risk. At the moment, we tend to kind of role play in terms of advice. I mean, one of the things that was highlighted in, is it John Heal's talk, which was a previous firm event, was about risk managers taking responsibility for risk. We don't take responsibility for risk, we advise on risk. And perhaps that's one of the things that GI actuaries might want to think about, PI cover kind of allowing. And we could then begin to define the right data requirements, which would be very difficult. But saying to people in a business, look, you can do a better job of this. We don't just have to collect aggregate figures of claims and total losses, all this kind of thing. We can actually get down to the individual claim level and start to get involved in case estimates, case management. And then develop better models once Howard's kind of developed that. And then the education system, I think I'm going to argue here that because we've got such statutory responsibilities, there's a lot of weight and responsibility on GI actuaries. The education system does need to deliver in terms of quality assurance. And I think that maybe stifles our original problem solving. And then finally, should actuaries look to broaden their experience? Yes, that'd be great, that'd be really good. But I don't think the actual job market would agree with that. They want relevant experience. It wants people who've actually done the job before they can get the job in the first place. So going off and doing risk management for ICI would be fantastic, but I think you're going to have trouble selling it to, you know, Aviva or whoever is arguing that actually you've got relevant experience. So I think it is very good to broaden our experience, but I do worry just how easily that can be achieved. So in conclusion, GI is ripe with unsolved problems. It is the exciting area in terms of risk management because there's lots of problems out there that we haven't solved. Okay, there are catastrophe models that model earthquakes and hurricanes, but there's big challenges in terms of calibration. As I said before, these disasters don't come around enough times that we can actually calibrate. Not that's probably the wrong way of putting that, isn't it? No matter. And then we have the capabilities, but we need to change our attitude if we are going to have more influence on the business that we deal with. So that's me. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks to our three speakers. We had three very different and three very thought-provoking talks there to introduce this. This is now your chance, ladies and gentlemen, to join in the debate and the discussion. We really are looking for any contributions, long or short, not too long, planned or impromptu, doesn't matter. The only things we ask you are, firstly, could you wait for the roving microphone to come, and could you give your name before you start speaking, just to help us. As I said earlier, don't worry about the television cameras, forget about that. Please don't wave at them and say, hi, Mum. And this won't be recorded, so you can say what you like. We don't mind. We do want to have a free-flowing discussion. Last instruction, if anybody's still got their mobile phone switched on, could they please switch it off? It says here in my instructions, it is not sufficient to mute the ringing tone. Your phone will still try to talk to its base, and this damages our equipment. So anybody's got their phone switched on, switch it off now. Right, who'd like to kick off? Anybody want to make a start, contribute? Yes, Catherine, and then Louise after that.
Thank you. Thanks very much. My name's Catherine Morgan. The question being debated is which kind of actuary is the best at risk management, life, GI or pensions? And before I start speaking, I should state that I'm a general insurance actuary and have been for nearly 20 years. My employer is a bank assurer, and recently we reorganised. One of the guiding principles of our reorganisation was risk management, as we previously had a structure with a high-level central risk management function and separate actuarial, credit and capital management functions, all separated in different ways from the three business areas, bank, GI and life. And our new structure recognises that risk management is an essential responsibility of the people in the front line, the people responsible for profit. And we also recognise that there should be support from a single strong second line of defence. So we put our new structure in the context of the ICAS regime and Basel II. We've got those at the heart of our processes. And we've got a good awareness of Solvency II, the new European solvency regime, at the back of our minds. So our second line of defence is also responsible for capital as well as risk management. So what did we end up with? Well, we've got a senior capital and risk manager for each of the main business areas. And between us, we're the chief risk officer for the whole enterprise. Each of us works very closely with the director of the business, who's got profit responsibility. Each of us is on or is represented on the business management committees covering risk management, pricing advice and capital advice. And for general insurance, I also cover claims and premium provisions. And whilst we're giving advice, we're also part of the management team for each of the businesses, and we're also responsible for the return on risk-adjusted capital. We act as second line of defence for the key risks, insurance market liquidity, and have a link to the board risk management committee in terms of reporting. And for operational risk, which is obviously the hardest to model, we consider this in each of the business areas and then review it on an enterprise-wide basis to make sure we're covering all our bases. Now, the risk manager for GI, which is me, and my opposite number on life, are both actuaries, and that fits in well with our capital management responsibilities and for looking after the ICA modelling. And in my view, the work we've done on capital for ICA has increased our understanding of risk management and puts us in a position of being able to implement a sensible, understandable risk management system. So my first conclusion is that there's little to choose between life and general actuaries in respect of risk management abilities. Although I do think Phil has a very large risk appetite personally by illustrating his points with scantily clad women. Turning to pensions actuaries, my views are slightly different. Looking at life and pensions from a GI perspective, it does seem strange that members of the same profession can and do value the same liabilities using different methods and come up with different values. My limited knowledge puts more credibility on the life actuaries, as they have been pushed and pulled into sophisticated methods and a good understanding of the risks inherent in their liabilities. Alongside this, I have a perception that pensions actuaries rely on the fact that even in defined benefit schemes, the benefits are not guaranteed in order to duck their risk management responsibilities. In my view, the profession should be thinking about members' reasonable expectations when valuing and advising on pension scheme liabilities, rather than for looking for what could be seen as disingenuous get-outs. So my second conclusion is that life and GI actuaries beat the pensions actuaries hands down. But that doesn't mean we should rest on our laurels. As a profession, we should be looking at ways of managing our future. Risk management is about finding the indicators that can tell us when things are not going to plan. As a profession, this should be a strength. And my third conclusion is that there's more work to do.
Thank you, Catherine. Louise, anybody else?
Yeah. My name's Louise Pryor. I was very excited when this whole thing of risk management, actuaries as risk managers, came up, because it's something I've been arguing for quite some time. And I was very interested in the talks we had this evening, though increasingly disappointed as the first two went on, because I thought we were being seduced yet again by banking notions of risk as purely financial. But I was relieved to hear James state quite a lot of what I intended to say, probably rather more clearly than I will say it, but I'll repeat it nonetheless, because I think it's very important. Not all actuaries are only mathematical, and indeed, we've had an ongoing pressure, drive anyway, in the profession to try and make actuaries broader than just mathematicians. And I think it's important that actuaries think about non-traditional forms of risk just as much as the forms of risk they're used to, mortality risk, investment risk, and so on. And, of course, an obvious example there is operational risk, which both in the general insurance area and in the life insurance area, some work has been done on. The important thing, I think, about these more less traditional forms of risk, well, less traditional from the points of view of actuaries anyway, is that they are less easy to measure. A lot less is known about good ways to quantify them. And they may well be more amenable to management. it's extremely difficult to control the behaviour of the financial markets, mortality and so on, whereas it may be a great deal easier to control other forms of behaviour. And we must remember, as I think this was a point that James made, that quantification is not the be-all and end-all, but just part of the risk management cycle, which, you know, it's a control cycle. We're all used to the control cycle. So as we think about ways to measure risk, we should think about ways that help us to make decisions about what we're going to do about risk. Just producing a number is not the answer. Just putting up capital is definitely not the answer. So what can we do to manage risks? Well, there's basically two ways you can do it. You can try and stop the bad things happening or make more good things happen, or you can try and make, if a bad thing does happen, to make the effect less bad, and that's essentially control and mitigation. So I think we have got to think about, as actuaries in our traditional forms of business, are there ways in which we can address those two aspects of the risk, and that may mean different forms of underwriting, whatever. We must also think about the other risks in our traditional businesses. How much work has been done on operational risk for pension funds, for example? I'd be very interested to hear of any at all. And I think that the operational risks in running a pension fund are by no means insignificant. And finally, we really mustn't ignore the risks that we ourselves bring to the business. Models can be wrong, both theoretically and in their implementation. A false sense of security based on overconfidence in misapplied techniques is itself a risk. And just finally, to come to some of the questions that have been asked, which actuarial fields are most advanced is, I think, the wrong question. Because, yes, a change of mindset is required to make the most of the opportunities. We've got to think about applying our actuarial ways of thinking in new ways to our traditional fields and to more non-traditional fields. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. There's one down here and then one at the back. John in the front here first. Sorry, down the front here. There we go.
Thank you. For a couple of minutes, I'm going to use the alias of Con Keating, who couldn't be here tonight, and he asked me to make a couple of comments for him. What he said was, and I agree with this, all finance is about effectively promising a double liquidity exchange, normally separated by time, because money has failed to be a reliable store of value. So institutions are making a promise, you give us some money now, we'll give you some money later on. Insurance companies do this, banks do this, pension schemes do this. Banks have to be focused generally upon the short term. Insurance companies, depending upon what kind of class of business they have, will be anywhere between short and very long. It really is dependent. But pension funds are normally quite long, although there are clear exceptions. The capital risk will arise and should be measured at the second liquidity exchange, right at the end of the horizon. That is when the exchange is being executed. That means, as far as I'm concerned, in a DB pensions area, and I'm speaking as Con, we should be looking at the horizon and discounting back. And the implication is that current market values don't necessarily tell us very much at all about future horizons. Reverting to my own identity as John Spain, I agree with that. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have said it. Or I would have said it, and then I would have said I didn't agree with it. Can I just make two more comments, though? First of all, it has been mentioned that there are other people out there called risk managers. Two particular groups are GARP and Premier. We should be working much more closely with them than I think we have been in the past. I personally would go for Premier because they're not as savage in terms of gouging out membership fees as GARP are. Secondly, can I just come back to this concept, which I hate to see claimed as a fact, and Cliff can already hear it before I say it. And this is the idea that pensions are bond alike. If you translate that as an absolute statement, it must be wrong. If you take it as a fuzzy statement, then it could be right. Some of the bond portfolio, sorry, some of the pension portfolio in a pension scheme sure is bond-like. For example, those benefits which are already crystallised are in payment, or there is going to be no more salary linkage based on. But the people who are still in service, expecting future salary increases over and above the absolute guarantees of revaluation, that is not bond-like at all. We should be building in some fuzzy stuff and not building in absolute statements. Thank you.
Right. I'm going to exercise Chairman's prerogative and ask nobody to respond to John's last point, otherwise we'd be here all night. I've got two Chris's now, one on the left and one on the right. So Chris, do you on the left first and then...
Chris Lewin. As actuaries, we are united. We work in different fields, but we're united in our common approach to risk. We all know that if there's a 50-50 chance of something going wrong, then 9 times out of 10, it will. I'd like to talk about enterprise risk management and the excellent opportunities it presents for actuaries, particularly outside our traditional fields, although it also has very strong applications within our fields, particularly for insurance companies. Enterprise risk management is ready-made for actuaries because it's all about having a focus and a methodical approach to risk and making a great deal of complexity simple enough for decisions to be made. Now, there's three types of risk in enterprise risk management. There's strategic risk, the really big things that might affect the organization or even its survival fundamentally. There's project risk, which is the risk on the various projects and change initiatives which the organization undertakes. And then there's operational risk, a whole host of risks of many kinds which are run day after day. You can think of them as a kind of triangle, where each corner represents one of those three categories, strategic, project, or operational. For the last 10 years, I've had the privilege to lead a working party of civil engineers, actuaries, and economists, which has been started off by looking at project risk. I think it's really useful. It's really useful that we have been able to cooperate with the civil engineering profession for such a long time. It's a real sign for the future that we'll be able to expand our cooperation with other professions as well and get a true spirit of partnership. The first product from this partnership is RAMP. I've got here the RAMP handbook, which is... The first edition was published in 1998, and the second edition has just been published. RAMP is a simple, straightforward process for controlling and evaluating the risk in major projects. It enables one to identify the risks, analyze the risks, and respond to them, and place financial values on them. And that's perhaps the dimension where actuaries can do more than many other risk managers. We can actually put a financial value on risks, which helps in deciding whether to accept the risk or take some action about it. Now, although I describe it as a simple process, when you actually come down to the nitty-gritty, it does involve techniques like scenario analysis or stochastic modeling to examine a range of possible outcomes from the project and their likelihood. But the net result is to reduce the chance of waste of resources on the project, or indeed just project failure. Now, although it's got a grounding in projects based on physical assets, bridges, trains, things like that, the techniques are equally applicable to any kind of project. And that's the point I want to emphasize. It's just as applicable to projects in the insurance field as to physical projects. So it may be the launch of a new product, it may be some new computer scheme or some big change initiative. It's just as applicable. And the other important point is that it is not just about downside risk, but about upside risk, in other words, opportunities as well. So that's project risk. The second component that I want to talk about briefly is strategic risk. This much the same group has been looking at strategic risk and will be publishing a guide next month called Strat Risk, a guide for directors. And again, it's sponsored by the actuarial and civil engineering professions. And it brings out the point, the key point, that managing strategic risk needs a different approach to managing project or operational risk. In particular, the board of the organization needs to give risk leadership and create in the organization the right culture, internal communication system, and risk management framework. And there's some special tools which are useful: horizon scanning, concept mapping, pattern recognition, and risk grouping. So that's the second of my three categories. The third one is operational risk. Quite a lot has been done already by the actuarial profession on operational risk. I've noticed one or two papers coming out from General Insurance. In answer to Louise, I myself have done work on operational risk in pension funds, for example, and I'm sure others have as well. But what are the principles in operational risk? That's what we need to try and get to. What are the things which are common to most operational risk situations? Everyone will have their special operational risks, but there's a whole lot that's common. So a group has been formed to start to look into that. So those are the three categories. So what does enterprise risk management do? Well, basically, it binds it all together so there's no cracks or overlaps, and so that everything is properly prioritized. And then it embeds these various techniques in the organization. Now, enterprise risk management is starting to take hold in the States, but also here. And I think we've heard tonight how one company is already doing it. It's just starting here for most companies, and some have not yet started, to be frank. But in 20 years' time, most companies will be employing enterprise risk management. And I believe that actuaries can play a leading role in the next 20 years in bringing that about. The business opportunities are immense, in my view, and it's really a question of how actuaries get into that kind of work, not whether they can do it. In my view, any actuary can be an enterprise risk manager. A study is needed to pick up on the work that's been done already, but there's no reason why anybody shouldn't be able to do it. What it needs is, as I say, simplicity out of complexity and a clear head. So finally, what is the role of the profession in this? I suggest that one of the roles of the profession should be to support enterprise risk management actuaries. There's already been a start with a seminar last November. I see there's another seminar coming up in July. I would hope that the profession will go on sponsoring guides of the kind it's been involved in already. There may, in due course, be an enterprise risk management guide, for example. And I think that the profession needs to run CPD to bring existing actuaries up to date in this field with what's been done already, and eventually bring appropriate material into its exams. So I think you can tell from that, I feel really excited about enterprise risk management. I really think that as well as looking at the traditional fields, and someone was quite right in saying that we may need, that individuals may need to do that to gain credibility before they go outside, but nevertheless, going outside has the most wonderful opportunities for expanding the profession, and I think we'll do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Chris O'Brien.
Thank you, Chris O'Brien. I'd like to make comments in two ways. Firstly, as regards the Life Board's working party on risk management in life assurance, which I chair, which we set up a couple of years ago, and secondly, more generally. So the working party did a survey of life actuaries, or chief actuaries, which was autumn 2004, and said, what are you doing about enterprise risk management? And we asked actuaries to rate their organisations on a scale from 0, which said we have no discernible ERM system, to 5, which said we have a fully functioning enterprise system, and the average score was 3.4, which compares with what they said they would have said 2 years previous to that of 1.8. Of course, I don't have a survey of general insurance and pensions actuaries to compare that with. Mm-hmm. But one or two other things that they were saying as regards why had they advanced enterprise risk management. One was good business practice, compliance with FSA regulations, and also corporate governance guidelines. And of the 39 respondents, 33 had an explicit risk function, 30 had a risk committee, 21 had a chief risk officer. We also asked them what they thought the skills were that were appropriate, were needed for the risk function, and the kind of maximum score of 5, and top came actuarial skills with 3.8, but then we were sending the questionnaire around to actuaries, weren't we? Next was 3.4, was accounting and financial skills, then was legal and compliance at 3.3, and operations at 3.2. And the survey also goes on to provide quite a bit of information about how companies assess risks, to what extent they use stochastic methods, whether they allow for diversification benefits, and the uses to which they put their risk identification and risk management processes. However, we did find some differences between types of firms, so that mutuals, for example, gave a slightly lower rating compared with proprietary firms. They gave on average 3.0 for their enterprise risk management function, whereas proprietaries scored on average 3.6. And the mutuals tended to give compliance with FSA regulations as the main reason for managing risk, whereas proprietaries regarded it as good business practice. And similarly, there were differences between small and large firms. The small firms were less likely to have appointed a chief risk officer and scored lower in terms of how they reported to the board of directors on risk. So that's the survey. It's on the profession's website if you want to find out more. More generally, then, I take it as read that if the profession is trying to make financial sense of the future as regards insurance and pensions, it must be doing all these things as regards the management of risk. It has no credibility as a profession if it says, no, that's not us, we can't be leaving it to the bankers, it has to be doing that. But that does mean a fair amount of effort to learn about it, making sure that we understand the issues, some of them that Chris Lewin has mentioned, that it's part of our education, our syllabus, that we support it through research. And there are two different strands to it. One is the technical financial bit, but the other bit is the business managerial bit of risk management. So, yep, we need to have the technical financial bits that we understand, the questions like, you know, what are the alternative measures of risk? How does it fit in with return on capital and so on? But there are also business and managerial questions about risk management. And just a couple of examples. There are surveys that look at, this is not particularly in the context of insurance, but why do some firms do more than others to control risk? And they find that one of the reasons that often is relevant is the remuneration incentives of the senior management and directors. Because management don't like losing their jobs, they have incentives to control risk. They may be rather different from what the shareholders are looking for. We need to understand that kind of issue. Another survey looked at firms that had suffered crises and others that hadn't suffered crises. And they found that firms that had a board of directors that had considerable diversity as regards the ages and experience of the directors were less likely to have had crises. We need to understand those kinds of issues. So, yes, we can be risk managers, but these things we need to understand. Risk management has certainly advanced in the insurance and pensions area, and it's been encouraged and incentivised by the regulators. I do have some concern that that's not quite enterprise risk management, which is looking rather wider. And in particular, the regulators tend to focus on the assets and liabilities on the balance sheet to make sure you have enough money to pay your customers. The shareholders are looking at the firm value, which includes goodwill, and regulators may not be too bothered about the risks to goodwill, but the shareholders certainly are, and I think that's an area in terms of the risks to the marketing, the brand value of the organisation that is sometimes underestimated. So, yes, risk management has been growing in importance in the actuarial areas, and we need to do more and to make sure that it is a core part of our education, our training and research programmes. There are areas outside insurance and pensions where there are also great opportunities for actuaries, but there are other organisations that are there already with a role, such as the Institute of Risk Management, which it has its own conferences, its education system, and we are some way behind it. And so while there are great opportunities for actuaries in ERM more widely, we should not underestimate the amount of work and effort that we need to carry out to get there.
There's one down the front here. Jeremy, and then one day.
Hi, Jeremy Goford. I wanted to follow up on Chris Lewin's comments on RAMP in particular, because it was one of my big frustrations 2 or 3 years ago when Chris came to me and said, the government has decided to adopt RAMP as the way of running big projects in government departments, and there are 12 of these departments. Can you tell me the names of 12 actuaries who can run RAMP? So we asked around, and as many as we could come up with was two, one of whom has since retired, and the other one is Chris. So here is a serious opportunity. The profession developed something, 7 years ago now? It's a manual to make money as an actuary outside traditional fields. And in 7 years, we've managed to generate two who are prepared to actually say that they do it. I think that's absolutely tragic. Nevertheless, it may be a demonstration that actuaries are very, very busy doing other things and haven't got time to do this other stuff. And I think that's also true. And I think, in my experience, actuaries are in more and more demand when the market-based comfort of market-tested models fail. In other words, where there's no significant market test to be had. And to me, the key is the mergers and acquisitions test, which is where I spent most of my life. And the process is for the sellers to commission a seller's report, which is then sent round the potential buyers, and a series of meetings between the actuaries, sellers' actuaries, and the buyers' actuaries, and in the white heat of 3 o'clock in the morning, for some reason you can only make decisions on M&A at 3 o'clock in the morning, but in the white heat of that, that is when these ideas, models, ways of working get refined, not just on market testable risks, but also on those where there is no there's no market basis. And that is where, in my mind, the actuaries have consistently been in demand. So to me, risk is making money from the expectation and management and development of risk, including in its costing, the cost of capital to support the volatility of the risk. And it was interesting to me, in the three presentations we had to start with, there was hardly any mention of capital or cost of capital being added in, although a lot of the contributions since have brought that in. And risk is not just that. It's also ensuring that those who win on the upside know that they are about to, and they usually do, but the trouble is those that tend to lose on the downside aren't told. And I have in mind here pension fund employees. And risk is about making sure that we do communicate to the stakeholders what risks they are they're running. And I think there's a way forward for pensions actuaries here. Instead of being pushed and shoved in the direction of financial economics and behavioural economics, they can take a great leap forward and say, yes, let's fully embrace market consistency where it exists, including valuation of operational risks. But I think there are some upsides on the pension side which haven't been examined. And I'll just give you an example. And that is the goodwill of the employees. Employees like to keep their jobs. And if you have a conversation with the employees along the lines of, do you want a company or do you want a pension fund, then that does tend to concentrate the mind. Now, if you put yourself, say, in British Airways' position and you said to the British Airways employees, look, we've got a deficit in the fund, N times the net worth of the company, what do you want, a company or reduced benefits, then I think you have a real conversation, and those conversations haven't happened. But I think these behavioural risks are taken into account in the M&A game, implicitly or explicitly, and the more explicit and transparent we can make these evaluations of these behavioural risks, then the more honest and open result we have, and actuaries do a better job. Thank you.
David Wilkie. The three speakers to begin with spoke from the point of view of pensions and general insurance and life insurance, and yet this has been run, at least chaired by Colin Wilson, from the Finance Investment and Risk Management Board, and there was nobody representing the investment actuaries for whom I would have voted in the first place. Because an awful lot of the methodology that we've been hearing about has come from the statistical approach to investments, the stochastic modelling of future investments, the sort of expanding funnel of doubt that Chris showed, the concept of value at risk, conditional tail expectations or tail VAR. All those come from the investment side, and then once the investment side's been looked at, people can turn around and look at the liability side in a similar way. The concept of hedging has been emphasized very much by option pricing. I know it was there in Reddington's original approach, but not the actuaries never elaborated it sufficiently beyond the original immunization into a full-scale hedging model. The concept of marking to market come from option pricing to a great extent. And so the pressure to use market values in pension funds has come out of the investment side, not out of the pension fund management side. However, having put in a plea for the investment actuaries, I do think we need to look at all the different categories. Each of us can contribute, or each actuarial field can contribute something. The pensions people and the life insurance people know much more about long-term liability risks and long-term discounting. The general insurance people do have long-tail business, but as James said, far more of their work is dealing with the uncertainty of the claim size. That isn't a problem in life insurance, apart from the bonuses. But the problem of uncertain claim size, of incurred but not reported claims, of all the time lag, interestingly, is coming in to, in a minor way, but it's a minor aspect of totality of life insurance, so it's a major aspect of the statistical analysis of critical illness results, where there are enormous time lags between events and claims, which doesn't worry life insurance seriously at all. People pretty quickly discover that somebody's dead and pretty quickly tell the life insurance company that they are. Not always, but reasonably quickly, a lot quicker than they do with critical illness events. So I think we all need to come into it. But I'd like to take issue a little bit with what Louise said and to some extent the way Chris Lewin was going. Risk management does seem a very big field. the one thing that actuaries can contribute to it is the statistical and mathematical expertise. Statisticians have this too, but are not used to working in this particular field of finance. The combination of statistical expertise applied to finance is something we can do. Health and safety is not something that anybody in this room is going to claim a huge expertise in. That's a different field. It's part of risk management. It's very practical. It's not something that we're especially expert on. And I can imagine, see, also with the RAMP side of it, which I don't know very much about, but looking through about the project management, an awful lot of it was the sort of sensible things that good managers, good engineers would be dealing with. But they're not something that actuaries have any special skill in, although I'm very glad that Chris and his colleagues put the thing together. But it seems to me so much outside the line of financial risk management that I'm not surprised that other actuaries haven't taken this up very much. Perhaps we should do, but operational risk, we have actuaries or statisticians have been looking at if you can get a handle on the statistical side of it. If it's not that, if it's just a matter of running the business sensibly, there are lots of other managers that can do it, and not only us. But we need to cooperate with all of them. It's not a unique business. I hope that actuaries do stay involved one way and another.
Thank you, David. Right, we're running towards the end now of our discussion. Anybody want to make any quick impromptu remarks? Anybody burning to say anything? Particularly some of our younger members who are here. Yes, somebody there. Great.
Okay, not younger, I'm afraid. My name's Mary Hardy. I hold the CIBC Chair in Financial Risk Management at the University of Waterloo, so I thought maybe I should have something to say about risk management. It seemed to me for a long time that there is no area of actuarial endeavor that does not involve risk management, and that's one reason why I couldn't answer the question at the beginning of the session, because like Louise, I kind of thought it wasn't the question I came here ready to answer. I could have answered a question on how much risk management science, what areas of actuarial practice can most benefit from learning more about risk management science? That would be perhaps a more current and interesting question to me. The way that we teach actuarial science these days, I'm going to talk mainly about education, is a three-pillared activity or a three-legged stool. It's acquired a third leg relatively recently, which is just as well because two-legged stools don't work very well. And the three legs are short-term diversifiable risk we learn from risk theory. And some of this is essentially repeating what David's just been saying. Long-term diversifiable risk we learn from life contingencies. And we've added financial economics, particularly financial engineering or mathematical finance, to deal with non-diversifiable risk. And most of what we do, essentially all of what we do, is some combination of all three of those, and almost everything we do involves a little bit of at least two of those. Louise would like me to talk, I think, about operational risk, so I'll add that in and take this as an opportunity to plug. My colleague Harry Panger has just written a book on operational risk that Wiley's going to be publishing soon. And so it's an interesting aspect of operational risk that traditional actuarial techniques, particularly in risk theory, are actually very applicable to many areas of operational risk. One problem with operational risk as a pillar, the reason it's not another leg of the stool, is it tends to be a catch-all. So it has a lot of both diversifiable and non-diversifiable elements. And therefore, a theory of operational risk, I think, is some way from coming. Philip and James, I enjoyed all three of the presentations. Both of them talked about the complexity and about needing to learn from other people. And Louise gave a great expression. She talked about overconfidence in misapplied techniques. What's happening with our risks is that the risks that we are managing is that they are becoming more complicated. And the management techniques available to deal with them are becoming more complex, deeper, more profound. And what the educational challenge that we have is how to deal with those. And the problem is that we're still dealing with them, particularly in the USA and in this country, not so much in Canada, is we're still dealing with them in an old model, in what I believe is an outdated model. And the outdated model is the teacher self in your back room, in your back bedroom, after a whole day of work. I've been through this model, and I know from having been through it how inefficient it is to learn deeply technical material. To learn deeply technical material, it is much more efficient to be in a university environment, to be taught by experts in that field, to have access to those experts when the material is not clear to you. And so I think if we are going to embrace risk management, the techniques, the sophisticated mathematics of risk management as a profession, we also need to think about embracing more deeply the university route for education. I know that the profession claims some interest in this, and there are diplomas, but it's the employers who are not buying into this, but the employers who are still interested, and since this isn't being recorded for posterity, in a basket-weaving degree from a 1,000-year-old university than a degree in financial mathematics or actuarial science from a 50-year-old university. Okay, one more thing I thought I should say. I have another role. I'm a member of the Board of Governors of the Society of Actuaries, and a few people have mentioned the SOA initiatives in ERM. The SOA is introducing an additional route to associateship. You will soon be able to become an associate of the Society of Actuaries through an ERM, an enterprise risk management stream, which, as I think Chris O'Brien was saying, is a broader topic than risk management. And I know that there are many on the Board of Governors of the Society of Actuaries who see this as a route to take over wider fields. I see it more as an imperative to secure our current domain. And the domain is actually what we are mostly defined by now. We are not the best statisticians in the world. We're not the best financial engineers in the world. What defines us is we're the best at dealing with our domains of insurance and pensions. And the concern is that the CRO jobs, even in insurance, the chief risk officer jobs, even in insurance, are not automatically being advertised to those with actuarial qualifications. In fact, there are many CRO jobs in the USA are being advertised to requiring a CFA qualification first, and an actuarial qualification is not recognized. So we need to embrace risk management and enterprise risk management to secure our own domain first before we start thinking about going and being the enterprise risk managers to the world, and to go off and advertise ourselves as the risk managers to the world before we've secured our own domain seems to me a bit like invading Iraq before you've secured Afghanistan.
Right, on that note, I shall now ask Donald Rumsfeld, Seamus Creedon, if he would like to close the discussion. Seamus.
Thank you, President, and ladies and gentlemen. My own views on risk management were formed some 20 years ago when, as an innocent actuary, I joined a banking organization to take it into the life insurance business. Following my joining, I was trying to explain the life insurance business to my banking director colleagues and to explain to them what actuaries did. I explained about pricing and about valuation. Wasn't really getting anywhere with this till the light bulb went on and said, oh, you do risk management. That encouraged me to find out more about how banks did risk management and to think about the differences between that and what I'd been used to. The first difference that was obvious to me was the strong focus on risk management in the interests of investors, a point which has been made by several people this evening. The second point was the emphasis on risk management as an organization attribute, as a system of the organization. I think a point which Catherine Morgan made. The design of the system is bigger than the roles of particular individuals. I think that's a different mindset perhaps for actuaries. A point which others have made is that risk management is an active process involving planning, organization, direction, control, and beyond all those, communication. It's a process which is qualitative as well as quantitative. It recognized the limits of quantification, a point several people have made. And another theme of the banking context, which ties in with our question about experience, is bankers generally believe that to manage risk well, you have to have had some experience of taking it. So they like to get the best, or not necessarily the best, but near the best traders and near the best lending officers involved in asset liability committees and credit committees and so on. We've had an excellent discussion stimulated by three very contrasting speakers. The themes which I took out of the discussion, and I will struggle to do it justice, I think there was general agreement that a change of mindset of some sort is required. The point about the change to market consistency from actuarial values was emphasized, already mostly there on the assets and getting there on the liabilities. Several of our speakers emphasized the investor perspective and seeing risk management all the way through from the investor perspective at one end to the capital markets at the back end. I think that raises perhaps some questions about the governance model for pensions, for example, which I suspect we'll come back to another time. A number of people made the point that our typical actuarial desire for the perfect can be the enemy of the practical. Or I think, as John Swain put it better, that sometimes fuzzy is more useful than absolute. Often fuzzy is more useful than absolute. Many speakers, again, echoed the point about the organisation of risk management. And I think Philip put over particularly well the importance of thinking coherently about the organisation of the centres within which risk and return are managed within organisations. A number of speakers contrasted the classical actuarial approach of concentrating on analysis and advice, so tying the answer up in a ribbon, presenting it to the board, off you go, with actually being involved in action, which I think fits with the point I made about the best people to involve in risk management are the people who have actually taken it. On education, we had several issues on what might form part of our education, and I won't attempt to repeat Miri's eloquent contribution on how we might approach our education. But some of the subjects I listed were a sense that the control cycle can be reinvented and broadened and made more portable between contexts. We can revisit risk and uncertainty, and Knightian uncertainty seems to become a fashionable theme these days, but it's perhaps one which more actuaries ought to be aware of. All models are wrong, but some models are useful. Learning to think outside the model box and what could go wrong with it, again, seems to be something we could develop more in our education. And perhaps the theory of firms, how firms interact with investors, with regulators, reconciling those different interests, I think was a point which was made by more than one speaker. I fully agree with John Swain's comment about the essential need to collaborate with other organisations in this field, Premier and GARP. We didn't have that much discussion of what experience is useful. I think there was some echo of the point that experiencing taking risk, experience of operations. I wasn't really sure why actuaries shouldn't think of being, for example, general insurance underwriters, or why underwriters couldn't make good risk managers. There may be more to be developed there. We had some debate, and I think it's probably a question of what the priorities should be, as between Chris's view that enterprise risk management is something which is essentially portable, and the alternative view that we have to start with our beachhead in insurance and pensions. Final question was, in this order, is which area actually is the makes for the best risk managers? I think all three opening speakers gave very good account of themselves. But I have to agree with Louise and Miri that we deliberately, I think, Colin, posed a question which was unfair and artificial. But it's not the first time that a wrong question has produced the right answer. And I think tonight's discussion showed that there's great potential for complementarity between the different practice areas for actuaries. And I'm sure it must also be the case that complementarity between the actuarial background and other disciplines brings tremendous value to risk management. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Seamus. Well, given the lateness of the hour, I won't add any comments of my own at this stage. I think we took a bit of a risk in having an informal discussion on risk management here, and I hope you agree that we've got a good return for taking that risk tonight. I'd like to thank all of those who contributed to the discussion, and I'd like to ask everyone to join me in thanking Colin and the firm board for organising this. Our three opening speakers, Cliff Speed, Phil Long and James Orr, and Seamus for closing. Thank you all very much. I'd like to draw your attention to a bulletin board that's been set up on our website. This is available after each session or meeting for anybody wishing to comment on any elements of the discussion. You can put your comments on there. It can be accessed via the forum heading on the top navigation bar as you enter the website. Anybody who wants to claim CPD for attending this meeting, please sign the forms that are available in the room at the back on your way out. The next meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 p.m. in Southampton at the De Vere Grand Harbour Hotel on Monday, 22nd of May, when there will be a discussion entitled Learning from Closure, an analysis and comparison of the issues facing closed life funds and closed pension schemes. And the discussion will be followed by a dinner down in Southampton. Further information and booking forms for the dinner can be found on the website. I'd like to mention two other events coming up in just over a fortnight's time. On Wednesday the 10th of May in this hall, we will be having a Reddington Centenary Lecture. The 10th of May is exactly the 100th birthday of Frank Reddington, who, as many of you will know, was recently voted in a poll carried out by the actuary as the greatest British actuary ever. We have a guest speaker from America who's going to update Reddington's work for the 21st century, and also a talk by one of Frank Reddington's colleagues, Sir Brian Corby, on Frank Reddington's work. The second date for your diary is Tuesday the 27th of June, which is our AGM. And as we have been doing in recent years, we will get through the formal AGM very rapidly and then have a guest speaker. And on this occasion, it will be Clive Cowdery, who has set up the Resolution Foundation, which is dedicated to improving financial advice available for lower middle income groups. And he'll be talking about the foundation and its aims. I'd like, in closing then, to invite you all to join me in the room at the back for a further discussion over a glass of wine.